Good afternoon. Welcome to the EcoNews Report. I'm your host this week, Jennifer Kalt, Director of Humboldt Baykeeper. The EcoNews Report is brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, EcoNews. Today, my guest is Jay Patton, who is a geologist and lecturer here at Humboldt State University, and we're going to talk about science, how to recognize science-based information, and conversely, how to recognize pseudoscience, or as we are calling them nowadays, alt facts. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Jay.
Thanks for having me here, Jen.
If you could just give the audience a quick background about you and what you study and what you lecture about here.
Well, I have a diverse background with half a dozen different majors before I got my bachelor's in anthropology, went to UCLA and California Institute of the Arts, and then I got my master's in environmental systems geology focus here, and then I went up to Oregon State University and got a PhD in oceanography emphasizing marine geology and geophysics, and I've been teaching undergraduate classes for the last 4 years, and this is my second year teaching as a lecturer at Humboldt State University in the Department of Geology. So I teach about earthquakes, natural hazards, energy, geographical information systems, paleoclimate.
Tsunamis.
Yeah, tsunamis, all sorts of natural hazards, floods.
For those who don't know, Jay has a great website, and he is also very active on Facebook and helps people understand a lot of the science behind earthquakes, things like the Fukushima disaster. You helped illuminate your friends and the greater world to the fact that people were misusing a map of
a simulation of tsunami wave elevations.
Right, and that had gotten passed around after Fukushima and portrayed incorrectly and misleadingly as radiation map.
Yeah. To save time, instead of telling each person individually about what the problem was, I decided to make my own map to help people learn about what the map was about that had nothing to do with radiation. And then I set up a web page where I help people try to develop their own tools to evaluate and critique information that they see on the internet.
Right. That is a lot of what we're going to talk about today. And that's a really critical aspect of science is communication, because you can't just do your science and file it away in a drawer and hope that the rest of the world is going to understand. Your website, which is earthj.com, a lot of this information you've been posting there, lots of great articles. And with the recent presidential election, this has become a really important subject because of the misuse of science and social media, the portrayal of complete fiction as truth or reality. A lot of people are thinking a lot more about how do we recognize pseudoscience. Why don't we just start there? What are ways that people can recognize what are alt facts or what are actual facts?
Well, a fact is something that is observable to be true. An individual may not be able to do this on their own, and that's why we need to enlist the fact-based opinions of subject matter experts. And I'm glad you mentioned how even I, as a subject matter expert in a certain field, I'm not a subject matter expert in another field, and so I need to rely on those people to help inform my fact-based opinions. That's really the key, is being able to evaluate something and use the opinions from subject matter experts to help inform you about whether something's a fact. So on the one webpage where I help people try to develop their own critical skills, I basically group sources of information about the radiation from Fukushima in three different categories. There's category one, which is based on peer-reviewed publications, newspaper articles, and journal articles that have gone through some editorial process, because there's been some review there. Group two, which is less credible, would be opinion pieces and blogs, like my blog. In some cases, people might present information that includes references, and that would lend it a little bit higher credibility. But no one reviews my blog. It's clearly in category two. And then category three, stuff that we clearly just need to ignore and set beside the way, throw it in the bucket. And these are really sort of easy to identify. I have made some observations when I was taking an atmospheric science class and we were studying the anthropogenic forcing of climate change. And I was going on the internet and finding all of these conspiracy theory web pages. I realized that they used a suite of strategies to lend credibility to their web pages. For example, I would find that there would be two or three different web pages that had exactly exactly the same content, and they would have web page links within one page that linked to the other page, and these pages had exactly the same content, but if you look at just one of the pages, you can see, oh, look, they are linking to their sources, so this must be credible. But when you realize that it was just linking to another web page that said exactly the same thing, and if, like, whenever I look at a web page that I'm unfamiliar with, particularly even journalism, you know, like news web pages, like someone writes articles for the Daily Beast, had criticized something I had posted on Twitter. And so I went to see the articles that he reads, and I was unfamiliar with the Daily Beast. So I went to see what people say about this web page. And that really helps me figure out what sort of bias does that web page have. So that's something that I learned in anthropology classes, was about modernism and postmodernism. And when postmodernism arose as a response to World War II French existentialism, we got postmodernism, where people started describing who they were at the beginning of their news article or their book that they were writing, because everyone was realizing that everything that we view is through our own filter. And so it's important to understand whose filter you're reading through. And so we always want to investigate, what is the source? What is the website? Who are they funded by? Are they a nonprofit? Are they ruled by a board of directors? Is the organization publicly on the stock exchange? There are all these things that go into evaluating the source of information. But I go back to the first group. The most credible sources are sources that have peer-reviewed journal references, and that is really important. And so the peer review process involves someone writing up their scientific study. They submit it to this journal, and then the journal editor reviews it, makes sure that it satisfies their goals, their mission for their journal, and then they send it out to other subject matter experts who are experts in that field. I review papers. Editors send me papers to review. And the first thing I need to do is I need to make sure that I feel I'm qualified subject matter expert in the content of the paper. And then these people review the papers and they critique them. They point out the problems in the paper and make a recommendation to the journal whether or not they need major edits, minor edits, whether it should be published or it should not be published, that kind of thing. And it's that review, which is an essential part of the scientific method, is reviewing other people's work. It's the last step. So the first step in the scientific method is someone makes an observation, or a group of people make observations. And the second step is they come up with a hypothesis to explain the observation. Then they formulate a test to test their hypothesis. Then they run that test. And then the final step is they evaluate the results and whether or not the results supported, rejected, or nullified their hypothesis. And that's the step where peer review is taking a place, is because you have people who might be anonymous, they might not choose to be anonymous, and they are reviewing the results of your test.
You know, this reminds me, the other day I was reading an article about one of the attacks on environmental laws in Congress and on the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency in particular. It was said that the Republican Congress wants to ban the use of any data that is not repeatable. On its face, when you're thinking about, well, how did we learn about science in elementary school? Well, it's repeatable, you know, you don't get different results. But then some of the EPA scientists pointed out that some of these experiments are not repeatable either, because they are based on a catastrophic event like Exxon Valdez oil spill. You're not going to repeat that. Or Fukushima, for example, you're not going to repeat that. And so while it sounds reasonable, if you really dig into the details of what that means, they are trying to eliminate science from decision making at the federal level.
That may be very well true, that certain organizations or certain groups of people are trying to eliminate science for some reason. I would add that there are lots of reasons why sometimes experiments aren't repeatable. And one of those, I just recently read an opinion piece. This person was talking about how sometimes the methods that are used are methods that have taken years for a certain lab to develop these methods. Someone else who might be a subject matter expert may not have the skills. It might take them a decade to develop those same skills to be able to perform that experiment. So there are lots of reasons why a certain experiment might not be reproducible.
It's helpful to talk about these things and how we can recognize when an argument is being used that doesn't really hold up to scrutiny. In this article, The Mistrust of Science, that was published in The New Yorker, the author said, it's important to be able to recognize the bad science has a pattern, and helping people recognize the pattern arms them to come to more scientific beliefs than themselves. Having a scientific understanding of the world is fundamentally about how you judge which information to trust. It doesn't mean poring over the evidence on every question yourself. You can't. Knowledge has become too vast and complex for any one person, scientist or otherwise, to convincingly master more than corners of it. The author talked about the five hallmarks of pseudoscientists. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about those different ways that people can easily recognize the tactics of bad science without actually having some knowledge in the subject matter.
Oh, yeah, these are great. This is an article that was written by Atul Gawande in The New Yorker on June 10th, 2016. The dean of the College of Natural Resources and Sciences, Rich, posted this on Twitter, and that's how I came familiar with this.
Rich Boone.
Mm-hmm. I'll briefly state these five things. One, they argue that the scientific consensus emerges from a conspiracy to suppress dissenting views. Two, they produce fake experts who have views contrary to established knowledge but do not actually have a credible scientific track record. Three, they cherry-pick the data and papers to challenge the dominant view as a means of discrediting an entire field. Four, they deploy false analogies and other logical fallacies. And five, they set impossible expectations of research when scientists produce one level of certainty. The pseudoscientists insist that they achieve another. The first one, they argue that the scientific consensus emerges from a conspiracy to suppress dissenting views. This is a classic strategy in arguments when people don't have anything to argue about. It's a diversion technique. If you see that in an argument, you can say, well, this doesn't have any factual content. Someone who is making an argument like that, they're not using facts to base their argument. They're just coming up with something to say.
Basically attacking the other person's argument.
Yeah, slinging mud. Yeah. Number two, they produce fake experts who have views contrary to established knowledge but do not actually have a credible scientific track record. So this goes to when I was talking about evaluating a web page and a website and who that website is, who funds it, that kind of thing. It's important to look at the author of the article that you're reading and see who they are, who funds their work. Do they have a PhD in that subject matter? Do they have a master's degree? Have they published peer-reviewed journal articles about that subject matter? That increases the credibility. Now, anyone can become a subject matter expert. You don't need to have a degree to become a subject matter expert. All you need to do is educate yourself on the facts. And those facts are best found in peer-reviewed journal articles because they've gone through the scientific method process and they've been reviewed. Cherry-picking the data. That's something that people do, and it's important when you're reading a scientific paper or an opinion piece. If someone actually makes a statement that is antithetical to their position, like let's say I present a paper that someone wrote about the subject matter that I'm writing about that disagrees with what I say, I should include that in my paper. And it makes my argument that much stronger if I'm including all of the material. So when you're reading a paper and they are actually including the papers that are contrary to what I'm trying to say, just lends credibility. Because then you know that they have an open mind, that they're incorporating all of the information and not just the information that they view supports their position. The false analogies and logical fallacies, there's a great poster on the internet, and I'll try to post it onto my science page about logical fallacies. It's a cartoon of like Plato and Aristotle having arguments and discussing what logical fallacies are. But do a little internet search on logical fallacies, click on the images tab, and you'll easily find this poster. And then impossible expectations of research. This is done when people don't really understand the science and what controls the factors that they're talking about. So this may be a good example. It may not be a good example. Okay. One of the subjects that is of local concern is the management of the dunes on the North Spit and South Spit and wherever. Okay. And different people have different opinions. Some of those opinions are clearly based on facts, and some of those opinions are not based on facts. I've been studying the geology of the dunes for over 20 years, and I know that all of these opinions, that there is a certain amount of the processes that we don't know about. So I try to emphasize that whenever I'm having a conversation with someone. There are groups that want to emphasize managing the dunes for the ecological function, removing non-native plants, replanting with native plants, restoring the processes that we think are the natural processes. And then there are people who want to manage the dunes for other purposes, like people's safety. For example, up in Oregon, they're planting non-native species to protect people from tsunami hazards. There's numerical modeling of tsunami hazards research that demonstrates that those higher dunes protect people from tsunamis. Now, I would argue that we don't have enough information about our local dune ecosystem and the sediment budget in our local dunes to be able to make an informed decision about whether or not we can manage for the ecological function in a place where people live. So I don't think we have enough information. There's a study that's ongoing right now, and I haven't been involved in the study. I don't know what they're studying. I don't know if they're going to be able to answer that question. But I know that we will know more after the study is done. We will know more. We still may not know enough about whether or not to manage the dunes in the area of Manila. I don't know yet. So we're just going to have to wait and see.
Well, that's kind of a hallmark of science, right? Is that you keep on revising and getting more information. It's a point at which science is often attacked where people say, well, yes, you don't have 100% consensus of scientists to say that humans are causing climate change. And we say, well, we have 97% and the 3% are mostly paid by fossil fuel companies to do alt science or fake science. But we live in kind of a, what you would call a litigious society. Not, I don't mean in terms of lawsuits, but I mean in terms of the legal standard of proven beyond a reasonable doubt seems to be the standard people want to apply to science, whereas there's no such thing as beyond a reasonable doubt in science. Like, really, almost ever, except, well, we know gravity is pretty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, gravity. A friend of mine was telling me, you know, like, after my K-Hum interview, Lindsay asked me to present a fact, and my friend was in their mind saying, gravity, gravity, gravity. And I mentioned my cup of coffee, which turned out to be a good example, but gravity would have been a great example. I'm glad you brought that up, because laws are used to regulate, to inform policy. Lots of policies are based on laws. And people think that our processes of reasoning that are based on laws are similar or the same as the processes of reasoning based on science. They're similar, but they're definitely not the same. So I always like to remind people, and many scientists don't think about this, that with science, we don't run around proving things, we run around disproving things. We don't talk about, for example, predictions. Scientists won't say that they're predicting an earthquake, but they might say, well, I'm going to make a forecast so that there is maybe some amount of percent likelihood or probability that there's going to be an earthquake in a certain given time period. And usually that's a time period of decades. For example, right now, there's a 35% chance that there's going to be a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake in the next 50 years. All right, so that's a forecast. A prediction would be, well, there's going to be a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake tomorrow. And scientists, you know, we just can't do that. There might be some fields that I'm familiar with where scientists can make a prediction. But I'm a subject matter expert in certain fields that I'm familiar with. And so for earthquakes and floods, we really don't make predictions. We make forecasts. But the legal world is a little bit different. And so there's the problem, I think.
Well, and that kind of brings me to the other thing I wanted to talk about, which is science and public policy, because science and science-based evidence is really important in public policy. But of course, it's not the only important aspect that needs to be considered. And I was thinking that a good analogy might be if people have ever worked on their own cars. You think to yourself, well, what could this be? And you maybe have three things that could be wrong with your car. You don't ever start with the most expensive and the most difficult one to fix. You don't start there. You take into consideration the facts that you know, the logic that you have from your knowledge and expertise, like, well, if the engine doesn't start when the key turns, what could that be? You have a couple of things. You don't start by rebuilding the engine. You know, you maybe start by jumping the battery, and then you maybe get a new battery or whatever. In public policy, it's a similar thing. You have to start with science and science-based evidence to make a decision. And there was a great piece by Lori Dingler in the February 9th Times Standard about tsunami and earthquake science in this region. I wondered if you could talk briefly about the link between the science of tsunamis, the history of tsunamis, and how we use that in public policy to develop the tsunami evacuation zones and the plans that keep people safe if there is a tsunami in the next 50 years.
That's a great example of policy that's based on science. Basically, in a very general sense, So for Northern California, how do we develop our policy? So we started by looking at the past geologic evidence records, and we found, as Lori wrote in her article, talking about Brian Atwater and Eileen Hempel Haley, and talking about how we looked at the geologic evidence for past earthquakes and tsunamis. And we've been developing that evidence ever since Brian Atwater published his first paper in Science in 1987. And then he got Dr. Hempel Haley to work with him, and she got her PhD up in Washington with Brian Atwater. And we've just extended that knowledge across the entire state of the coastal part of Washington, Oregon, and here in California. So that's the first step, is to document what we know about the past and to propose that that might happen again. If we've had earthquakes and tsunamis here in the past, well, we might have those again in the future. So then the next step was that the state ran some numerical simulations of tsunami inundation. And after, you know, they ran a whole suite of different scenarios, they produced in 2009 a map with a line on it saying, well, this is where we think a tsunami would inundate the coastline. We took that locally and we extended those lines to geographical locations, landmarks that are easy to identify. For example, if the inundation line ended somewhere in the middle of a cow pasture, we extended that line to the road because that's something that people can easily identify. And then we produced these evacuation zone maps where everywhere in the yellow part of the area is an area that you would want to evacuate out of if the ground shook for, let's say, 20 seconds or more. These maps are available on the Redwood Coast Tsunami Work Group webpage. So if you do an internet search for Humboldt.edu and RCTWG, you'll find these maps and you can find out if you're in a tsunami evacuation zone. Then we took these maps and we put up signs on the roads letting people know that they are entering a tsunami hazard zone or not. So the state of Oregon had conducted a study on tsunami inundation, and they did a little bit more sophisticated study, and they've calibrated their inundation models with tsunami deposits. Their tsunami inundation models are the hallmark for people globally to do tsunami modeling. And so now the state of California is soon, I hope, going to be presenting the results of their models. So they're using this probabilistic model where they run a whole bunch of inundation models and they assign probabilities or the chances that a tsunami will get to a certain area. And then they will be presenting that to subject matter experts, and subject matter experts will take that and inform the local community on where the tsunami inundation might be. And it might be a little bit different than the maps that we have now. And then we might choose to modify where our evacuation zones are or not. But do we want to have our tsunami inundation model informing where our evacuation zones are? Or do we want them to be based on an imaginary opinion? So when I first moved to Humboldt County in 1991 and moved to Manila in 1996, so I've been living there for more than 20 years. When I started studying earthquakes of the subduction zone and tsunamis, I was talking about tsunamis, and my good friend at the time said, well, I've never seen a tsunami. What are the chances that a tsunami is going to come here? I don't think they're very high. That was not a fact-based opinion. That was an opinion based on their imagination. I think it's very important that we use science to formulate our policies.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, one person's lifetime observing tsunamis is not enough to decide whether there could be a tsunami here or not.
Absolutely. The average time in between these tsunamigenic earthquakes that trigger these tsunamis is on the order of centuries, so much longer than an individual's observation. Another example is with the recent flooding and evacuations downstream of Lake Oroville. There was recent interest in an article that Jack Durham wrote in June of 2015 in the Mad River Union, and also posted on the Humboldt Baykeeper Facebook page, where Jack presented these inundation maps, which were prepared by the Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District. They wanted to know what would happen if the dam that holds back the water in Ruth Lake, which is our water supply for lots of people in Humboldt County, in Eureka, McKinleyville, and Arcata, what would happen if that dam were to fail for some reason? So they did a numerical analysis of the water flooding down the Mad River Valley. In the same way, it's much smarter, much better to use that that science to base our policy on our the Office of Emergency Services should use science, the results of that of those analyses, to configure their plans and response for something like that, instead of asking the opinion based on someone's imagination. You could ask someone, well, do you think it's going to flood here if the dam breaks? And the person could say, well, I've never seen a flood like that, so I don't think so. Well, that's their opinion, and then everyone's entitled to an opinion. That's what Scotty said in Star Trek. Everyone's entitled to an opinion. But whether or not we want to formulate our policy based on an opinion that is founded on imagination or science, it's clearly that we want to use science.
Right. And of course, other issues come into play. Like, for example, with evacuations, we know from Hurricane Katrina that if people are told you can't bring your pets to a shelter, a lot of people are going to stay behind rather than abandoning their dogs and cats. So that's a cultural aspect of implementing an evacuation plan that the Office of Emergency Services needs to take into account that is really important, although it's not a scientific fact.
People value their animal.
Yeah, it's not a scientific thing. Yeah. It's an emotional thing that guides people's behavior. And so it's very important to consider. In Oroville, I sadly read a number of people saying, you know, we're really worried about our pets that we had to leave behind. But, you know, that dam is the tallest dam in the United States, which I was really surprised to learn. It's been there for 50 years. And of course, it's never failed before.
Yeah.
And it could be a long winter for the people who live downstream of that dam. So hopefully it won't fail and we can learn from this.
It's fascinating. Speaking of animals and pets, yeah, a social media, like a Facebook page, was created by people who were evacuating. I was reading it and they were communicating to each other, oh, you know, here's a place where you can bring your horses. So it was really great to see people networking on social media to help each other. So
yeah, very important. I want to wrap up here a little bit by talking about the March for Science that's coming up on April 22nd. That's Earth Day. And there is a Humboldt March for Science that's in the planning stages right now. We have a closed Facebook page right now until we're ready to announce the location and the time of the event. But we have almost 2,200 people on that Facebook page. And if people want to stay informed, they can ask to be included in that Facebook page, the Humboldt March for Science.
Thomas Dunklin, I think, is...
Yeah, Thomas Dunklin, Ross Taylor, and I, Ellen, Dave Farrell, are all administrators of that Facebook page. So you can contact us if you want to be added to that. The founder of the March for Science that's going to be held on that same day in Washington, D.C., Caroline Weinberg, who is a public health educator and a science writer, she said, "The point of science is getting to the truth and helping us understand the world, and acting as though this has no role in politics is ridiculous." And I bring that up because a number of people have said, well, why have a March for Science? Because science is supposed to be apolitical. But we know from working in the real world of science and policy that science is political. Pretty much everything is political. You know, the idea of the March for Science is not just for scientists. It's for people who value science and want to support science. And that means, you know, supporting researchers that are funded by the federal government and all the agencies, federal agencies that do really important work, from tsunami and flood hazard planning to protecting endangered species and predicting sea level rise and all the things that are really important to the future, but also public health, you know, researching medicine and so many things that, you know, if you think about, there's really very little that we value that doesn't rely on science. We hope a lot of people will come out in this celebration and support for science on April 22nd. How can people find out more or take action? And one way is by going to your website.
Yeah, earthj.com, and there's a tab that says science. And if you click on that tab, the first choice is Facts and Science. I prepared this page originally in response for my radio show with Lindsay Battle on KHUM. I'm keeping that page a live page, and I'm updating it, including material from this interview, this radio show here, and I'll continue to update that. And if anyone has any suggestions on what I should include or could include, or if they think I'm wrong, please contact me. My email address is on the main page. And so hopefully I can keep that page updated to help people become more informed about what a fact is, what science is, and help them grow their faith in trusting scientists and subject matter experts.
Right. It's great work that you're doing, Jay, and especially helping people understand how to not spread fake news is really important in this day and age because there's way too much of it out there. Just real quickly, I want to talk about other ways people can make a difference because I've been getting a lot of calls and emails, as have many of the other environmental advocates here locally. How can we make a difference? You know, this is coming from a lot of people who want to get engaged and they aren't really sure where to start. So there's lots of suggestions. My first suggestion is to support to a reputable news source by subscribing to support their efforts. We can't just always expect journalism to come free.
That means to pay.
Yeah, it means pay. You know, whether that means subscribing to a local newspaper like the Eureka Times Standard or a national paper like the Washington Post or both, if you can afford it, you know what the reputable sources are. Subscribe, read, stay informed. Don't allow yourself to become apathetic. Take breaks when you need to. Watch Saturday Night Live when you need to. Laugh a lot, but also stay informed. Another great way to get involved at the local level is to become a member of a group or groups that work on issues you're most passionate about. So what that means to become a member doesn't necessarily mean you have to pay membership dues, although we rely on donations and support from our members. And that's very important. But also really important is to sign up for action alerts and take action when those groups call on you to take action. Find out when your local governing bodies meet, like your city council, county supervisors, etc. Try to go to one meeting a month. If you need assistance figuring out where those bodies meet, you can certainly go online or you can call some of those local environmental groups like Humboldt Baykeeper or North Coast Environmental Center. At the national level, there's plenty of national nonprofits. Same thing. Become a member, sign up for action alerts, and do the actions that they're asking you to do. Call and email your representatives in Congress, for example. If you aren't familiar with how you do that, this Friday, tomorrow, the North Coast Environmental Center will hold a teach-in to help people to learn how to affect change in Congress. That's going to be led by Dan Seeley, who's an NEC board member who lives part-time in Washington, D.C., and he's a retired scientist with the National Park Service. He follows Congress very closely. That teach-in will be tomorrow night, Friday, February 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the North Coast Environmental Center, which is now at 425 I Street in Arcata, around the corner from Richard's Goat Tavern. So there's lots of ways to get involved. Of course, it's not just environmental groups, it's social justice groups, Planned Parenthood, it's all kinds of women's rights groups. You know, there's so many ways people can get involved. With that, thanks so much for being with us today, Jay. I really appreciate you taking the time to help us understand more about science and alt facts.
Thanks, Jen. It was a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to our continuing conversation about science and facts.
This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Jennifer Cult with Humboldt Baykeeper, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Jay Patton, geologist and lecturer at Humboldt State University. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the KHSU archives at khsu.org. And now we're podcasting the Eco News Report as well. You can subscribe at iTunes, and please leave us a review. Previous shows are also posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. The Eco News Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next week for the Eco News Report.